Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Russian President Vladimir Putin suspended all of his country's commercial flights to Egypt Friday. He acted as investigators continue to probe whether a bomb brought down the Russian jetliner last weekend that crashed into the Sinai Peninsula, killing all 224 people on board. The Russian leader acted quickly after the chief of the country's FSB security service recommended the halt in flights. Russia had for days dismissed as speculative suggestions by U.S. President Barack Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron that Islamic State insurgents planted a bomb aboard the Metrojet flight from the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh to St. Petersburg. British vacationers encountered long delays in leaving Sharm el-Sheikh Friday. Here's British Ambassador to Egypt John Casson.
Flights are coming in that will allow us to take more people home later today. They're just challenging logistical issues involved in making sure that flights can leave and arrive in a busy airport in line with international regulations in a way that's safe. We're working through those issues. We've got very good collaboration, and our expectation is to get as many people home as soon as possible.
That's British Ambassador to Egypt, John Casson. Officials in Moscow said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov met by telephone Friday on efforts to widen international political talks on Syria to include both opposition groups and the Assad government. Russia's foreign ministry reported in a statement that Lavrov and Kerry also discussed the multinational fight against the Islamic State. This is VOA News. White House officials say U.S. President Barack Obama has concluded that Israeli and Palestinian leaders will make no significant progress toward peace before he leaves office in early 2017. That pessimistic forecast was disclosed as Mr. Obama prepares to host Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House on Monday. Political campaigning in Myanmar is drawn to a close ahead of a national vote that could bring to power Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party. Western nations and human rights groups are calling for fair, free, and transparent elections on Sunday. At the U.S. State Department, spokesman John Kirby has said key U.S. officials are closely watching the elections as an index of Myanmar's progress from military dictatorship to democracy. Kirby says the United States is focused on ensuring that the conduct and outcome of the elections are as credible, transparent, and as inclusive as possible. U.S. President Barack Obama on Friday rejected construction of the controversial Keystone Oil Pipeline from drilling sites in Canada through the central region of the United States.
This morning, Secretary Kerry informed me that after extensive public outreach and consultation with other cabinet agencies, the State Department has decided that the Keystone XL pipeline would not serve the national interests of the United States. I agree with that decision.
Mr. Obama said it would not make a meaningful long-term contribution to the U.S. economy with job creation or lower already low gas prices for U.S. motorists. The president said he called Canada's new Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to inform him of the decision. Environmentalists have long claimed that the Keystone project would damage the fragile environment in its path. The U.S. said Friday its labor market rebounded sharply from 3 months of weak job growth. It added 271,000 more jobs in October and likely eased the way for the central bank to raise interest rates next month. The Labor Department reported the U.S. unemployment rate edged down to 5% last month, the lowest rate in 7 years. The world's largest economy shrugged off a sluggish manufacturing sector, showing strong job growth in professional and business services, healthcare, retail, food services, and construction. A banana plantation owner and the former head of Haiti's government construction agency will face off against each other in Haiti's presidential runoff next month. The Electoral Council announced that banana entrepreneur Jovenel Moïse and Jude Celestin will face each other. I'm Sarah Williams.
That's the latest
in
world news from VOA. Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Celebrations were held across Cameroon on Friday, commemorating President Paul Biya's 33 years in power. Opposition parties are calling on Biya to consider stepping down when his current term ends in 2018. But there are no signs the 82-year-old president will.
That's Smokey Edwin Kinziga reporting from Yaoundé. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, the U.S. State Department is engaged in trying to solve the European refugee crisis and others around the world. An Australian journalist returns to Nairobi this week to the Kenyan city he called home before he and two of his colleagues were arrested in Egypt in 2013. And the AU has been building a standby force equipped to combat terrorists. But are they ready? We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the French Interior Ministry is bringing in busloads of migrants from neighboring countries. This in response to critics that France wasn't taking in enough migrants. Paris earlier agreed to accept only 30,000 migrants, but now plans to take about 300 more per month from Italy and Greece. The government plans to settle them in towns and villages in the Loire Valley and other central locations. However, French border guards will temporarily reinstitute controls on its borders in advance of a major international climate control conference in Paris later this month. Authorities are on alert against possible terrorist attacks. About 80 heads of state are expected to attend between November 30th and December 11th. In related news, the Greek ferry strike has ended, and today more than 24,000 migrants are being transported by ferries and other ships to Piraeus, the major mainland port near Athens, and two port cities to the north. An estimated 25,000 migrants were stranded on several Aegean islands during the four-day maritime workers' strike. Greece has become the most popular of migrant routes to Europe during the crisis. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department is engaged in trying to solve the European refugee crisis and others around the world. One of those directly involved in that effort is Catherine Wisner. She's Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. She visited VOA studios this week. In part two of an interview, Wisner spoke to Joe DiCapua about mixed migration.
The crisis of people arriving in Europe right now involves a significant number of refugees from Syria, from Iraq, from Afghanistan and Eritrea. Those are the top nationalities. But there are also many people who are migrating looking for economic opportunity. And a lot of those are coming from countries in West Africa. And so this is where we get the term mixed migration, because you have economic migrants and asylum seekers traveling the same routes and arriving in the same places in Europe, but actually requiring a coherent policy response, but ultimately a different policy response. I heard the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights say recently something that I really liked, that even as we talk about these distinctions between categories of refugees and migrants, you know, we're not talking about a distinction between deserving people and undeserving people. All of these people are seeking a better life and have rights, and that should be the starting place for any of our responses.
Now, you were in Africa touring the various refugee situations there. Did you go to the Dadaab camp?
I have been to Dadaab in recent years. In May of this year, when Secretary Kerry visited Kenya, we made a point of having him talk to some refugees, and what we actually did is set up a video link so that he could talk to secondary school students in one of the top schools in Dadaab. And we sort of wanted to make a point that even in this very remote region, in the largest refugee camp in the world, it's actually a complex of five camps, where some people have been displaced for more than 27 years, and some would say there's very little hope when you have second and third generations being born in exile, that there are actually really dynamic, well-educated, ambitious young people who still hold out great hope for what they can do with their lives in the future. So these students who had won the award as the top secondary school were discussing with Secretary Kerry what they wanted to be when they grew up, everything from human rights activists to politicians, but also noting that they were concerned that as they completed their education, they didn't know what their next opportunities were. And the secretary really encouraged them to say, getting an education is never a waste of time. Who knows when the opportunity may present itself for you to go back and help to rebuild your country or possibly have an opportunity elsewhere in this world. You know, the best thing you can do right now is focus on your studies and maintain this positive outlook. But I think that that's really difficult for people who have been living, again, in exile in refugee camps for so many years, who don't see a solution to their problems. And it's one where we have to continue to invest. And a lot of it is allowing people to actually become self-reliant and live meaningful lives, even as refugees, and not just sort of day-by-day basic care in refugee camps, confined to those camps.
Just about everyone you talk to says conflict is not going to settle these situations, that there needs to be a diplomatic solution. And of course, that's part of the State Department's role, trying to find solutions in a peaceful way. How difficult is that when you look at the situation and you see so many of them? How busy is the State Department trying to engage in that aspect?
Yeah, incredibly busy. I did just come also from South Sudan, where our special envoy for South Sudan was there, you know, meeting with all parties to the conflict there, seeking their commitments to implement the peace agreement that they signed recently. So our diplomats are engaged, you know, in the South Sudan crisis, the Boko Haram crisis, Central African Republic, the Great Lakes. We have, you know, top U.S. ambassadors and officials appointed to focus solely on trying to resolve these conflicts and to support African peacemaking efforts and to work behind the scenes to get buy-in to various negotiations that are going on. So it's a top priority, but it remains obviously an elusive challenge when you see so many people who remain displaced by these conflicts.
What would you tell the American people about why it's important for, or if it's important for the U.S. to be engaged in these matters?
I think it's important on many levels. And people, I think, individually connect on many levels as well. I mean, first and foremost, I think we give humanitarian assistance as a nation because it's a matter of values. And we do see, you know, whether it's a family and a child in our own neighborhood or in the Central African Republic, if you actually stop and think about their lives and hear them talk about their lives and what they want for their children and for their families and for themselves, you realize that actually we all want the same things. But it is also a matter of national security and regional stability. Managing borders around refugee movements can be difficult. Conflicts can spill over borders. And none of these things are good for stability in Africa, which is ultimately not good for stability globally. And that's a core interest of the United States as well.
That's Catherine Wisner, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration. She visited VOA this week and spoke to Joe DiCapua. Australian journalist Peter Greste returned to Nairobi this week to the Kenyan city he called home before he and two of his colleagues were arrested in Egypt in 2013. Greste thanked the East African Press Corps today for their support throughout his imprisonment and discussed the importance of press freedom. Jill Craig has more from Nairobi.
Before a crowd consisting primarily of friends and colleagues from the Foreign Correspondents Association of East Africa, journalist Peter Greste gave a news conference in Nairobi Friday, thanking them for their support during his period of 400 days in an Egyptian prison.
We saw people pull together in a way that made it impossible, I think, for the Egyptian authorities to hold on to the idea that we were genuinely working as terrorists.
A reporter for Al Jazeera English, Greste was living in Nairobi when he traveled to Egypt in December 2013 to provide short-term coverage. He and colleagues Mohamed Fahmy and Bahir Mohamed were arrested by Egyptian authorities, who accused them of supporting the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood and for reporting news they deemed damaging to national security. Greste said that he and his colleagues were convicted in a trial that was universally recognized as a sham and as a travesty of justice.
If Egypt had a problem with Al Jazeera, then it should have dealt with the network, not with two Egyptians and an Australian.
Greste says he feels a sense of responsibility to use his experience as a way to continue advocating for press freedom and freedom of speech.
And I think it's important that we keep talking about it. We keep reminding people why this is important, that we keep press freedom alive and we don't let it slip away from us.
Greste was released and deported from Egypt in February this year under the terms of a presidential decree, although he still carries a criminal conviction and an outstanding prison sentence. Since then, he's been traveling around the world advocating for press freedom. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi pardoned Fahmy and Mohamed in September. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
For more than a dozen years, the African Union has been building a standby force equipped to combat terrorists. Late last month, more than 5,000 troops from across Africa's five regions have practiced fighting an imaginary army at a South African training base. Are they really ready for battle? Well, VOA's David Arnold reports from Washington.
There are more than 80,000 African troops in combat zones in Africa. Most serve as peacekeepers. When crises occur in Mali or the Central African Republic, it is the French who send in the combat troops. Africa may soon have its own force. The African Union recently tested the skills of more than 5,000 troops brought together for field exercises at a South African training base. Officials say the African standby force will be fully operational by the end of December. An African security and governance expert says they did well enough, but most of the bill is being paid by the European Union, the United States, and others. Thomas Mandrup says that's a big problem. Mandrup is an African security and governance expert at the Royal Danish Defense College in Copenhagen, Denmark.
That is the big elephant in the room. I think the military is quite often capable of doing what they're told. So if they're told to send troops to a certain country, they will manage if they have resources available and they get the mandate. The problem is, it's of course the political will to do that. As it is now, African Union operations are 90% financed by external donors, which means that the local ownership of this is too little, which makes them vulnerable because when you are dependent on others to finance you outside Africa, that of course is a problem. So I think the biggest challenge for the African standby force idea right now is the political will amongst the political leaders in Africa.
The African Union agreed to come up with 25% of the budget for the standby force, but Mandrup says that's not enough. He says another problem is that militaries that are being asked to fight on the same side are seldom willing to share intelligence with one another.
If you're going to do, for instance, intervention operations in hostile environments and you're not capable of sharing intelligence, for instance, that is going to be a problem, because if you do not have the trust that you can share vital information about where you're going to deploy, of course you've probably.
The original concept of the standby force was five regions of the African continent, each contributing a battalion to answer the call of the African Union. Mandrup says commanders and other military experts now talk about creating smaller forces capable of operating in rainforests. He illustrates the problem Nigeria has experienced.
What is it that we have been training the African forces for? I think the Nigerian force is an excellent example of the problems that donor-driven transformation and training programs in Africa has often been faced with. We train them in our own, so speaking, Western image. And what they are faced with are insurgencies, gangs, and ill-equipped rebel forces, which are strategic asymmetric in relation to what we are, where you need a different kind of force, not big battle groups like we have in NATO, but you need mobile, small operational forces, lightly equipped, which are flexible and can operate around the clock to chase the enemy away.
Mandrup says the argument within the African standby force for smaller forces has taken hold in Nigeria. For several years, the military had made little progress against Boko Haram. Mandrup says Nigeria hired a South African firm that recently helped Nigeria to turn the tide against the terrorists in three northeastern states.
So they reorganized the whole structure of the Nigerian armies into these small mobile units, away from the American training. You know, we have to remember that the Americans have trained Nigerians for the last 12 to 14 years. But the training was more of a conventional thing, and they were faced with the Boko Haram. It was not very useful. So what the South African military company did was it used the doctrine that the South African used during the border wars in Angola and so forth. And that has shown to be quite effective. The success we saw from the Nigerians against Boko Haram in March was based on this kind of strategy.
But Mandrup says that the crucial issue for the African Union standby force remains how to pay for it. Africans continue to leave the continent to seek asylum from political instability and to look for jobs in economies that are thriving.
Politically, it's going to be an issue somewhere down the line, especially with the new migration problem to Europe, because that is, of course, something that has made this whole structure even more urgent that it is in place, because these issues, what we see in Sudan, what we see in Somalia, what we see in Mali, what we see in northern Nigeria and others, can eventually become a problem for Europe with the migration and all that.
The theme of the African Union's military initiative is part of what they call African Problems, African Solutions. With the rising numbers of Africans leaving their homeland, Africa's problems have already become the world's problems. This is David Arnold for VOA in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on 21 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The U.S. State Department is engaged in trying to solve the European refugee crisis and others around the world. Australian journalist Peter Greste returned to Nairobi this week, to the Kenyan city he called home, before he and two of his colleagues were arrested in Egypt in 2013. And the AU has been building a standby force equipped to combat terrorists. But are they ready? And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Well, celebrations were held across Cameroon today commemorating President Paul Biya's 33 years in power. Opposition parties are calling on Biya to consider stepping down when his current term ends in 2018, but there are no signs the 82-year-old president will. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Yaoundé.
President Paul Biya's supporters sing as they organize activities to celebrate his 33rd anniversary in power. Professor Jacques Famindongo, a frontline supporter of the octogenarian, says Biya's backers have a moral responsibility to celebrate the leader's successes, especially for the internal peace Cameroon enjoys. He says as they celebrate, they remember thousands who have either died or are suffering from the Boko Haram insurgency, which he says could have been terrible had Biya not declared war against the terrorists in the north of the country. He says people should join him in counting the blessings they have enjoyed from Biya's leadership.
Il suffit de mesurer à travers toute l'étendue du territoire l'ampleur des réalisations du renouveau national. Nous pouvons citer.
He says it suffices to look all over the national territory and people will see the achievements of Biya: schools, universities, health centers and hospitals, rural and urban electrification projects, and drinkable water plants are some of the successes. He says Biya promotes development all over Cameroon without any favoritism, and that the Cameroonian leader assures territorial integrity and rights and freedoms for everyone. But Cameroon's main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, does not have such a rosy view of the long-time leader. Senior party official Alim Nambarga says they are using Biya's anniversary to ask him not to seek another term.
Il faut savoir qu'en 1982, le Cameroun était un pays émergent parce qu'avec un taux de croissance de 7%.
He says Cameroon had 7% economic growth in 1982 when Paul Biya became president, and that the country was on a path to becoming an emerging economy like Brazil, China, Korea, and Japan. But today, he says the economic growth rate has dropped to less than 3%. He says there is no democracy, no freedom of expression, falling moral standards and poor justice systems, and that Paul Biya has failed. Youth leader Clarice Yimgang is skeptical Biya will heed the call not to run again. She says Biya has not helped most Cameroonians because they remain jobless after completing their education.
When you go to our ministries, the secretaries, and people who work there are people who were employed in the days, in the 80s. I don't think that the youth in this country really want to go through that kind of process anymore. They go to school with the view of getting jobs in other countries where education is valued.
Biya was prime minister for 7 years beginning in 1975, then became president following the resignation of the Central African States' first leader, Ahmadou Ahidjo. In 2008, he revised the 1996 constitution to remove presidential term limits, allowing him to contest and win the 2011 election. Biya is now serving the fourth year in his seven-year term. Asked earlier this year if he will be a candidate in 2018, Biya said, and I quote, "It is not he who wants, but he who can, that will be able to lead Cameroon." Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations warns that the Burundi president's call for collection of illegal weapons may spark weekend violence. Pierre Nkurunziza gave citizens 5 days to turn in weapons or be considered enemies of the state. Monday is the deadline. Ambassador Samantha Power's statement issued yesterday calls Mr. Nkurunziza's ultimatum irresponsible rhetoric that could trigger more killing. France has called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council on the Burundi crisis. Some residents fled their neighborhood in Burundi's capital yesterday after they found four bodies on the streets. More than 200 deaths have occurred and more than 200,000 people have been displaced since President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for and won a controversial third term as president in April. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 27 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
Your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The U.S. State Department is engaged in trying to solve the European refugee crisis and others around the world. The AU has been building a standby force equipped to combat terrorists, but are they ready? And celebrations were held across Cameroon today commemorating President Paul Biya's 33 years in power. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Kim. Special guest in the studio this evening. Can we get some
Yay!
On my right this evening, Austin Okon-Akpan, head of sports at Channels Television in Nigeria. Sporty greetings, Austin.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. This is unbelievable. You know, Sonny was on my show 2 weeks ago, and I promised him there was going to be a payback. So this is Payback Friday.
Payback Friday. I love it. Now, Austin, I know one subject that's trending in Nigeria, as well as all parts of Africa. We're going to have an all-African final in Chile at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup Football Tournament. Give me a shout-out for those Golden Eaglets.
Massive shout-out to the Golden Eaglets of Nigeria. So you know what this means? It means the world is going African. The world is Africa. In 1993, it was Ghana and Nigeria in Japan.
Okay.
In 2015, it's going to be Mali and Nigeria. And I'll tell you this, Sonny, it's been a fantastic outing for both Nigeria and Mali. But let me stay with where I'm from. You know, I'm not being biased, but I'm proudly Nigerian. And the Golden Eaglets, they have been fantastic. Let me give a big shout out to Oji Okonkwo that scored a 34-yard screamer.
You know what? I was watching
that game online, Sonny, and when Okonkwo scored that goal, my network froze. The network felt the power behind that. And remember that gave Nigeria the lead over Mexico? And then from there, it was the Golden Eagles.
Exciting contest. I watched the second half on television here in the Washington area. And just end-to-end action between the Mexican boys and the Nigerian boys.
Shows you the rivalry. Because in 2013, in the United Arab Emirates, we defeated Mexico twice, played the opener with them, and defeated them again in the final. So they didn't want light thunder to strike for the third time, but Nigeria said no. You know, it was a tough one. The Mexicans, they've been a little bit compact. They understand their game. But the Golden Eaglets, remember, the FIFA Technical Study Group came out to say they have about the best tactics at the competition. So shout out to Coach Emmanuel Amunike. He's doing a good job, a former Super Eagles player. And in his days, he was very fierce with his attack. And that's what he's doing with his team.
Austin, how much credit do you give Coach Emmunike for the performance of the Golden Eaglets?
I'm telling you, Sonny, if there's anything as 11 over 10, He gets all the love because he tells the boys, look, this competition is developmental, but just know that you can take it from here to the senior national team. In 1993, we had Nwankwo Kanu, we had Wilson Aruma, Celestine Babayaro, we had fantastic players such as Peter Anosiki, we had fine players that grew up the ranks. Remember, Kelechi Iheanacho in Manchester City, the Under-17 World Cup brought him out. Taiwo Awoniyi also. Special shout out to this guy. A lot of people talk about him, Sonny. A lot of people talk about Victor Osimhen.
Oh, great.
Who is scoring the goals.
Great performance. I think he has set the joint all time scoring record in Chile.
That's what we do. We break records, Sonny.
Nine goals.
And something tells me he's going to make it 10 in the final because he must get a goal on the final day. But special shout out to the captain of the team. He's been doing all the job in Wakali.
Okay.
Kelechi Nwankwo has been a fantastic leader. He's gotten 4 goals and about 6 assists. Scored a beautiful free kick that brought Nigeria into the game against Mexico. And then he's been leading the team continuously. So I think that's a good player that should even be going for the MVP.
Now, Austin, I know many Nigerians are probably already thinking about lifting that trophy on Sunday, but perhaps before we get ahead of ourselves, there is a Malian team to play on Sunday, and they've been impressive.
They've been so impressive, and I saw highlights of their game against Belgium. They sat back, monitored the way the Belgians were attacking, and then discovered how to catch them on the counter. The Belgians lose the ball, and then the Malians take over, and then they go to score. Now, this is how it's going to work, Sonny. We will not play this game on Sunday as we're playing the FIFA Under 17 World Cup. We'll go back to the Under 17 Championship in Niger.
Okay.
In Niamey, the Golden Eaglets couldn't go beyond the semifinals. Mali went on to win. Nigeria lost out to South Africa, and Mali went on to win. Now, there's been so much about this Malian team that we can learn from that competition in Niamey. And then when you fail, you don't want to fall again.
No, no. Now, from a geographic perspective, Austin, we have two West African teams in Sunday's final. Does that, again, speak to maybe that the power in African football is in the western side of the
continent?
That's
what it is. You're not saying anything wrong, Sonny. That's where that's where sports, in fact, in West Africa, there's Ghana, there's Cameroon, there's Nigeria. Now, the Malians, they're doing big things, you know, with their football. Not just football, even with volleyball, with table tennis, with badminton. So it's just, West Africans are the go-getters. They just want to win. And they go to win.
Austin, what do you think of the quality of football we're seeing in Chile from these young boys?
Fantastic. I watched the Croatian team. Now, let's take Africa out of it. They play good football. Bring Africa back to it. South Africa, yes, they didn't go far, but they played good football. And remember, Sonny, the objective of this competition is developmental. Don't put pressure on the team. Just go out there, see what you have for your future. After this rank, some players will graduate into the under-20 and then maybe play in the Olympics team and then make it to the senior national teams. We've seen good football. It shows the future is a bright one.
If you're just tuning in to the sunny side of sports, I'm talking with Austin Okon-Akpan, head of sports at Channels Television, our VOA partner in Nigeria. We're going to take a short programming break, and then I'll come back and talk more African football with Austin.
The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C.
The Voice of America.
VOA. Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the Voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. My guest this evening on the sunny side of sports, Austin Okon-Akpan, head of sports at VOA Partner Channels Television. Austin, we just heard from President Obama. Maybe he'll be tuning in to Sunday's
FIFA
Under
17
final.
He will definitely watch it because he's proudly African also. And listening to him, I could feel his love for Africa right there and, of course, for African football. He will. If he's got the time, I know he will watch.
All right, let's put you on the spot, Austin. Gaze into your soccer ball. How do you see Sunday's final? Nigeria against Mali.
Sonny, I tell you, It's going to be a competitive final game where the lads will come out to have some fun. Both sides love scoring. But, of course, the Nigerian team, they've scored more goals than the Malians. The Malians might just want to watch the game. And by the time they're trying to watch, Nigeria will catch them on the counter. I'd see that game ending. Nigeria 3, Mali 1.
I got to go with the Golden Eaglets.
You don't have a choice.
Look for number 5. I have no choice. It's got to be Nigeria.
Yes, it is. 3-1 Nigeria will win that one.
All right, Austin, let's go up to the senior level. Mm. Big week next week in all across Africa. We got a series of World Cup qualifying matches for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. I believe the Super Eagles of Nigeria are traveling to Swaziland for a two-match series.
Mm-hmm.
I got to go with the Super Eagles
in
that one.
You have to, but there's no room for complacency because it's a very crucial game. It's the 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifying game. You win this game, you go to the main business. The Swaziland team, they also love scoring. And what does this mean for African football? African football is getting competitive. When you're meeting a big team as the Super Eagles, you want to brace up for a tougher challenge. Might just be wishing, praying for an upset. Guess what? Coach Sunday Oliseh and the Super Eagles team, they understand that. So they're going to Swaziland with one thing in mind, victory. And then when they come to Port Harcourt in Nigeria, we just seal it up because Nigeria cannot afford to slip in the qualifiers.
You mentioned Coach Sunday Oliseh, Austin. Do you think he's gradually getting a little more comfortable in charge of the Super Eagles?
Yeah, that's right. And, he's also an ex-international. He understands the ego that is involved in managing these players. He also understands the need of Nigerians to see the Super Eagles play at the 2017 African Cup of Nations and the World Cup in Russia. Nigerian football is in a state of emergency. We'll beat any team. If we play the VOA team, we'll bring the A team. Beat them silly. Because that's what it is at the moment. So Kosoni Olise understands that objective and is trying to do it with different teams. He's rebuilding a team, but he has one word in his mind, victory. Just to keep the football fans together again because, the heartbreak has just been crazy lately.
Finally, Austin, we have just a minute or so left. Your first visit to Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. What do you think of our headquarters?
Fantastic, Sonny. Friendly, African. I see a lot of people smiling. And that's what is reassuring. You know, when you come to your workplace, it should be fun. You should feel the passion. And I'm chilling at the sunny side of sports. What are you talking about? It's fun all the way. So I'm so excited to be here. In fact, super excited to be here. And guess what? When you came on my show 2 weeks ago, I told you I was going to pay back. Now let me say there will be a second coming.
Payback. My special guest, Austin Okon-Akpan, head of sports at VOA Partner Channels Television in Nigeria. Thank you, Austin.
Thank you so much, Sonny.
I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Wow, lots and lots of high energy in the studio today. Thank you so much, Austin. Very nice to meet you, and thanks for the energy. Sonny, I think you met your match as far as the energy goes.
I did meet my match.
You can listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Well, coming up, traditional African staple grains are now showing up on North American grocery shelves and are gaining popularity. And South Africa's most famous comedian gets a gig as the new host of America's The Daily Show. But was his debut a splash or a belly flop? First, here's Speedo of Sierra Leone with Your Eyes.
Your eyes. God gave you a heart of gold, a destination of happiness, to a world most forget. I will love you forever. That's tomorrow, it may be the ending. For me, it may be the beginning. So baby, come, let's go.
Come, let's go.
Darling, come, let's go. Yeah.
Come, let's go.
Oh, baby, come, let's go.
Yes, for you to go. Woman, I love you and I need you every now and then. But I take your place, and I need you everywhere, every now and then. No one can take your place. And I want you to go up the sun, me, in every way, every day, everywhere. I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It may be the beginning. So baby, come, let's go.
Come, let's go.
Oh, darling, come, let's go. Yeah.
Come, let's go.
Oh, baby, come, let's go.
Come, let's go.
So baby, come on to me now. Yeah.
Your eyes.
Your eyes. Well, lots of cultures around the world have a staple grain that's little known or little grown outside of its home region. Three examples: teff from the Horn of Africa, quinoa from South America, and amaranth, the grain that fed the Aztecs in Central America. A lot of these grains are now showing up on North American grocery shelves and are gaining popularity. Correspondent Tom Bonsi tracked down some early adopters who invited this wave.
Wayne Carlson became a convert to Ethiopia's staple grain while doing public health work in Africa in the mid-1970s. The tiny grain is called teff. It has a mild, nutty, or earthy taste.
I came to know teff because I was eating it all the time and hosted by teff farmers.
Teff flour is the key ingredient for the signature spongy flatbread found in Ethiopian restaurants. In the late 70s, Carlson returned to the U.S., married, and settled in southwest Idaho. Then he hatched the idea to introduce teff grass to North America in his home state.
Geologically, it's very similar to Ethiopia. Ethiopia is placed on the East African Rift Valley, which is very much like the Snake River Plain.
Neither Wayne nor his wife Elizabeth are farmers, nor do they want to be. So they convinced actual farmers in Idaho, Oregon, and Nevada to grow teff on contract for them, and they mill it. Until last year, though, there wasn't a single Ethiopian restaurant or bakery in the entire state of Idaho to sell the milled flour to.
The way we started was Wayne went through the Washington, D.C. telephone book and looked for the names that were Ethiopian.
And that's how the business slowly grew for several decades, serving the far-flung Ethiopian and Eritrean immigrant community in the U.S. The teff company has outgrown four different mills. The first was a little stone grinder in the Carlson's basement. They currently occupy a remodeled brewery complex in Nampa, Idaho. The Carlsons say the teff flour coming off this packing line now could well land in an upscale natural food store or commercial bakery. According to an industry trade group, sales of alternatives to modern wheat are growing at double-digit rates each year. Teff production in the U.S. exploded over the past decade, says Oregon State University research agronomist Rich Roseberg. It's gone from 1,200 hectares in 2003 to more than 40,000 nationally by 2010. Roseberg says the majority of the teff grown in Washington State, Oregon, and back east is destined for livestock forage.
It's a good livestock forage in general, but it does seem like horses have a preference for it in some informal taste tests where we've compared teff with other common grasses.
In Idaho, however, where the Carlsons are based, Roseberg figures more of the teff production as grain for human food. Teff contains lots of nutritious calcium, iron, protein, and fiber. Roseberg credits Wayne Carlson for being ahead of his time.
So he recognized the value of teff, at least for teff grain, long before any of the rest of us did.
The University of Nevada, Reno, is leading a project to breed improved varieties of teff. The aim is to make it more productive and drought-tolerant in anticipation of harsher growing conditions due to global warming. A marketing flyer for the teff company says, "Move over quinoa, there's a new grain in town." The new grain is actually an ancient one, but Wayne Carlson is not fond of the term ancient grains to describe the category.
Teff was never really a relic. It was never bypassed by history, and then someone went back and said, well, this is good, why don't we still have it? Teff has always been the mainstay crop for millions and millions of people. And it's just that they were geographically isolated in Northeast Africa. Mm-hmm. So all we've done is said to the rest of the world, hey, look, there's this really good stuff there. Why don't you incorporate it into your diet?
And the rest of the world is doing just that. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Nampa, Idaho.
Watch out, America. South Africa's most famous comedian has landed as the new host of The Daily Show. But was Trevor Noah's debut a splash or a belly flop? From Austin, Texas, VOA's Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell asked Americans what they think of Africa's favorite comedian.
Trevor Noah's debut as host of the wildly popular American news parody The Daily Show has caused ripples on both sides of the Atlantic. With South Africa's foreign minister taking time out of her schedule at the United Nations General Assembly to visit the comedian in his New York studio. In his native South Africa, the popular comedian was widely hailed as brilliant, earning praise on social media from people as diverse as comedians, the nation's sports minister, to the national rugby team. But on this side of the Atlantic Ocean, Americans described his debut with an American word that needs no translation. Meh. In fact, in the youth mecca of Austin, Texas, VOA News found exactly one person from among dozens we approached who actually watched the show on Monday night. And that one person does it for a living. Omar Gayaga is a technology and culture critic for the Austin American Statesman, the largest newspaper in the state capital. We sat down with him the morning after.
Like I really don't feel, based on the first episode, that it was much different than The Daily Show under Jon Stewart. The writing felt very similar. I mean, there was one new correspondent, but the other correspondent bit felt like something right out of the Jon Stewart Daily Show era. And except for that it's a different guy, I mean, to me it felt very much like a substitute teacher trying to hype everybody up over the same lesson plan.
Noah, who is 31, was touted as the younger, cooler version of Stewart, who grew progressively more ornery and gnarled during his 16-year tenure. Noah underscored this point by referring to Stewart as Dad during his opening monologue. But it appears the new dad, Noah, will have to try to win America's youth, many of whom said they just did not watch the show. Justin Huebner, a 28-year-old bicycle taxi operator, took pity on this exasperated reporter and patiently, slowly explained this phenomenon.
I think because a lot of people don't watch TV anymore, at least a lot of younger people don't watch TV or don't have cable.
But, I ask Gayaga, is it possible that Noah's sharp wit, which to this reporter's ear hit all the right notes and made some cutting observations about the harsh reality of the world and the United States, was lost in translation? He answered by using another Americanism. The debut show was not, he said, a home run. That, he explained, is a baseball metaphor.
The guy with the bat hits the ball, it goes out past, you know, the fence, and that's a home run.
And they run in circles?
They go around the bases. It's a diamond. So there's first base, second base, third base, home base.
Wouldn't it be easier to just run back and forth and then, like, be more civilized and maybe stop for tea in the middle and, you know?
That sounds a lot like cricket.
It's clear that Noah, a fixture of the South African comedy scene, will need time in the anchor's chair to learn how to speak to his new American audience. Or maybe, with luck and hard work, he'll teach the world a new language, one that will make us all laugh. Anita Powell, VOA News, Austin, Texas.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Security Council is supporting an African Union, or AU, decision to investigate human rights abuses in Burundi. The 15-member council said in a unanimous statement issued on October 28 that it was deeply concerned by the continued rise in violence in Burundi following the re-election of leader Pierre Nkurunziza. The United States welcomes the United Nations Security Council's presidential statement on Burundi and the Council's continued attention to this crisis. Like the AU's communique of October 17, the Security Council statement put particular stress on the urgency of convening an inclusive inter-Burundian dialogue among the government and peaceful stakeholders within and outside the country. As such, the Security Council reemphasized the importance of the mediation efforts led by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni on behalf of the East African community and as endorsed by the AU. The United States stresses the Security Council's call for any dialogue to be inclusive and represent the voices of the citizens of Burundi, said U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby. He said the U.S. also welcomes the Security Council's strong condemnation of all violations and abuses of human rights and acts of unlawful violence committed in Burundi, both by security forces as well as by militias and other illegal armed groups, and its expressed determination to seek accountability for the perpetrators of such acts. Mr. Kirby noted that the U.S. is encouraged by the leadership of the United Nations in addressing the ongoing crisis in Burundi, particularly through Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's public offer in his October 27th statement of any support necessary to advance the implementation of the measures agreed upon by the members of the AU Peace and Security Council. The United States stands ready to support the AU, the EAC, and its designated mediator, President Museveni, and the citizens of Burundi to urgently conduct such regionally mediated dialogue outside of Burundi, which represents the best path forward to resolving the insecurity which has plagued the country since President Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term in contravention of the Arusha Peace and Reconciliation Agreement.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohammed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.